Rise. Chief Judge and Judge of the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals draw near. The court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. The court is called to order. As part of Project Outreach, we are hearing oral arguments today at the University of Houston Law Center. The court calls the case of United States versus Senior Airman Chad A. Blatney. Miscellaneous docket number 2016-16. Today we consider one issue during oral argument: whether the military judge erred by suppressing Appellee's act of unlocking his cellular phone, as well as the contents of Appellee's phone, pursuant to the Fifth Amendment. Government counsel, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 5 minutes, please.
Very well, you may proceed.
Chief Judge Drew, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Major Mary Ellen Payne, and along with Major Meredith Steer, we represent the United States in this case. The military judge erred in suppressing Appellee's act of unlocking his phone and in suppressing the contents of his cell phone pursuant to the Fifth Amendment. In order for there to have been a violation of the Fifth Amendment, there had to have been actual compulsion or coercion. But in fact, in this case, the military judge actually found that the consent to search, that Appellee's consent to search his phone was completely voluntary. And the same reasons underlying the military judge's finding also apply to the reason or the basis for why or for understanding why he unlocked his phone also. And we have to look at the fact that the OSI agents placed no type of pressure on Appellee. They made no threats. They made no promises. They spoke in very calm tones for the duration of the interview. And they made no attempt to get Appellee to change his mind about speaking with them about the underlying crime. At most, in this case, there could have been a violation of Edwards v. Arizona because Appellee did invoke his right to counsel, and the request to search Appellee's phone and the request to unlock his phone came after the invocation of that right. Now, in order to violate Edwards, the agents would have had to have continued to interrogate Appellee after he asked for an attorney. And our definition of interrogation comes from Rhode Island v. Innis, and it says that interrogation is any words or actions that the agent should have known, knew or should have known, were reasonably likely to elicit an incriminating response. And it's very well established in military courts and in federal circuit courts that merely asking for consent to search after the invocation of the right to counsel does not violate Edwards. So why then would the act of, or I'm sorry, why then would asking someone to unlock their phone be a question that would be likely to provoke an incriminating response? It simply wouldn't.
Counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
Does the government intend to elicit in front of the finders of fact testimony that regarding the appellant's response to the request to unlock the phone? In other words, I know that the military judge ruled that they were suppressing both the accused's response as well as the search of the phone, but it's really not clear from the motions that the government actually ever intended to offer into evidence that the accused physically unlocked the phone.
And our position is that the government absolutely does not have to introduce that evidence, and that they should not, they just for appellate reasons. Since they don't have to, there's no reason to elicit that testimony. They can authenticate the phone in other ways, Your Honor. They can authenticate it based on the fact that appellee had the phone on his person when he entered the interview room. He put it on the table. He was carrying it around, and the agents went and they retrieved the phone from that same table. They knew that it belonged to appellee. Further, after they searched the phone, Your Honor, there was information, or there were pictures of Pelly that were found on the phone, and they were able to match the phone number within their internal databases to link it to a Pelly. So there's absolutely no reason that the government has to introduce at trial a Pelly's act of unlocking its phone.
All right, so you would concede then that the act of unlocking the phone could communicate that the phone was in fact his phone, and that he had access to that phone and the ability to unlock that phone.
We believe, yes, that those are statements that are implicit in the act of unlocking the phone. That doesn't necessarily mean that they are protected by Edwards, but we do believe that, yes, it's technically a factual statement that is related by the act of unlocking the phone.
Could there be a factual scenario that information, that this in fact is his phone and he has access to it, could be incriminating?
There certainly could be certain factual scenarios where that would be the case, Your Honor. Not in this case. For example, if there was a, suppose OSI was searching for a stolen cell phone or something, and it was found on the accused person, and then the accused unlocked it, that might be evidence that he now has dominion and control over the phone. It might tend to show that, you know, he had taken this particular phone with a particular serial number. He had taken it in, he had unlocked it, and he had now put his own passcode on it. So certainly there are factual scenarios where it could be incriminating for the accused to be unlocking the phone, but this is not one of them, because there's nothing inherently incriminating about owning a cell phone, about having a passcode on a typical iPhone or smartphone. I would say that most people probably do, and it's not because they are hiding evidence of a crime on that particular phone.
Now, if they're being asked to consent to the search of the phone in a criminal investigation, that seems as though it ramps up the likelihood that the subsequent search of that phone might actually contain some incriminating information. What's the test that we talk? Is this interrogation? Is it likely to lead to an incriminating response? What do we look at, how the case develops to determine whether or not ownership of that phone was a critical piece? Or do we just look at what the agents knew at the time? Or do we just assume that in a criminal type case, a very important fact is going to be the accused's access and control of whatever the information is they're trying to search for?
Well, I think that the Supreme Court, in discussing active production cases, has been very clear that it's going to be a very fact-dependent scenario. So we're going to have to look at all of the facts and circumstances, you know, beginning with what the OSI agents know, and even ending with what is found on the phone. But I think it's important to acknowledge that in Doe 2, the Supreme Court rejected the idea that just because a statement of the accused leads to incriminating evidence, that there's somehow a link in the chain and that the incriminating evidence that's eventually found should be suppressed. In the petitioner in Doe 2 asked the court to adopt such a test, and the Supreme Court flatly rejected it. Now, Hoffman, and in a case, is a case that's often cited when discussing the act of production, and it talks about a link in the chain of evidence. But I think it's really important to look at the exact wording of Hoffman. It talks about evidence that it would furnish a link in the chain of evidence needed to prosecute the claimant for a federal crime. And I think that language, needed to prosecute, is extremely significant here. Because as we talked about in one of your very first questions, Your Honor, the government does not need the appellee's act of unlocking his phone to prosecute the case. And so I think that that's what we look at in this, we look at here. Yes, it did lead to, yes, the act of unlocking the phone did lead to incriminating evidence, but that act is not needed. The government does not need to introduce it.
How relevant do you think the production compulsion cases are to resolve this case, where it is a consent and it's a question related to a consent given to search?
Well, Your Honor, I think they do provide helpful guidance, but number one, we have to look at the fact that those cases, there was all an element of actual compulsion because they involve subpoenas, they involve the All Writs Act, they involve motions to compel, and that simply is not the case here. This is a consent search, a consent that was found by the military judge to be completely voluntary, and certainly there's nothing in the record that would suggest that that finding by the military judge is erroneous. So I do think that they are helpful. They're helpful in considering the foregone conclusion doctrine, such as, well, what did the government already know in this case? And did what they found out by the appellee unlocking his phone, did that actually add anything to the scope of their knowledge? And it certainly, it didn't in this case, Your Honor. I mean, we look at, it was fairly obvious, and it's not disputed by anybody. It's never been disputed by appellee that this was his phone. It was obvious he was carrying it on him. He left it outside the room. Certainly, that's enough to authenticate the phone for purposes of entering the text messages into evidence.
Counsel, let me ask you. I think case law is pretty clear that after an invocation of counsel, you can still request consent, and that's almost defined as not being interrogation, almost per se. So the question that becomes in a situation like this, it's the access issue to the thing that they've asked consent to search. In this case, it's a phone. So in that, I think you're arguing that just access is just a facilitating the consent. But when it's accompanied by additional questions, what's to guide whether that becomes interrogation or could lead to incriminating responses? In this case, for example, they requested access to the phone, but they also were asking, what kind of phone do you have? What color is it? You know, those are the questions in this case. But more generally speaking, could you have a case where more questions are asked? Let's say, for example, this was a case not of drug use, but of possession of child pornography found on some kind of digital media. And suddenly the investigators are interested in looking at any kind of computer where this may be. And now they're asking questions about, where's your phone? How many phones do you have? After they've gotten consent. I mean, wouldn't that be a different scenario? So the question is, what is the common question or the legal rule that's going to help us get through these kind of cases? So I understand, start with once access is requested, and just say what you think the Fifth Amendment does not allow going forward in terms of requesting actions or asking questions.
Well, and I think one of the cases that we cited in our brief was Garcia, and it talked about, you have to look at how closely the question relates to the underlying crime. And again, it's tough to draw lines, Your Honor, because it's really going to be factually determinant. And again, but I think that's a useful test. You know, how close does the question relate to the underlying crime? So if we're asking a question about what kind of phone you have, and the crime in this particular case was use of drugs, then there's very, very little connection at all. Now, you know, if there's a question about a computer and maybe, you know, an IP address or like, where do you keep your computer? And he says he keeps his computer in his home, and maybe the IP address associate that the authorities already have information on, maybe that is located at the same place where the accused is saying that his house is. I mean, certainly in that case, his statements might be more connected to the underlying crime. So I think that that's a helpful guide. But in this case, there's just very, very little connection at all between the phone, the ownership of the phone itself, and the crime of drug use.
But counsel, so if I understand your argument correctly, you're basically saying that it was permissible in this case because, you know, the phone itself the access to the phone really wasn't all that connected to the underlying crime. But here we are in one of the very rare instances in which the government can actually appeal a trial judge's ruling. We haven't even actually had a trial yet. We just had a beginning of a trial. The judge suppressed this evidence. Didn't throw the government out of court, just simply suppressed this evidence. And under our limited rules, that there are circumstances when the evidence is significant enough that the government can take this kind of an extraordinary appeal. So doesn't that kind of go against the argument that this is not that important, and so therefore we shouldn't be looking to suppress it?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not suggesting that the evidence that was eventually found was not important, but I think when we look at when the question was asked by the OSI agents, they at that point did not have any reason to believe necessarily that asking him or saying something that might get him to admit to ownership of the phone was going to lead to incriminating evidence. And I think that has got to be our starting point, because when we're talking about Edwards, the question is whether or not the agents said something or did something that was likely to elicit an incriminating response. And at that point, there was certainly not a lot of connection between the crime and the question that was being asked, not where they would have known. I mean, so take, for example, again, you know, we talked about cell phone ownership, but what if there was a belief that someone had stolen a car or that a car had been used to facilitate a crime? And then the accused in that, or the suspect in that particular case, was asked to identify the car, or asked, is that car over there yours? Well, at that point, the agents really did have an idea that that particular car or admission of ownership of that particular car was going to be incriminating. But at the point that the agents in this case were asking the question, they didn't necessarily have that same type of belief. And so, therefore, the question was not protected by Edwards. Now, it did end up, yes, that they found incriminating evidence, and it is very helpful evidence to the government to show that the appellee had consciously used drugs, because in these text messages, he's talking about the urinalysis that happened and demonstrating consciousness of guilt, suggesting that perhaps the urinalysis was not going to come back being negative. So certainly it is an important part of the United States case, and it's certainly something that this court has jurisdiction over.
Let me ask you this. If I get this scenario correctly, so the OSI, the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, brings the then accused in and to interview him, interrogate him, whatever you want to define it. There's some preliminary questions to, you know, kind of get at ease, and then they read him his rights under Article 31 and to include his right to counsel, and he requests counsel at that point. So we have a clear invocation of counsel. You agree with that?
Yes, I agree with that, Your Honor.
And then after he has invoked his right to counsel, it's then they ask him if he wants to consent to the search of his cell phone and other items, correct?
Correct. That's what happened.
And so at some point, shortly thereafter, there's this discussion between the accused and the agents about, well, is your phone unlocked? Can you unlock it? Correct?
Correct, yes.
Now, in this case, they didn't ask him what his, you know, secret code is that right?
They did not. They just asked him to unlock, if he would unlock the phone, and he did.
Exactly. So that's my question. What if he had refused to unlock his phone? What could the agents have done at that point, if anything?
Well, Your Honor, the agents testified that they did not believe that they had probable cause to get a search authorization, and I believe that that is backed up by the record. There isn't anything in the record to suggest that there was evidence of a crime contained on the phone. So they, at that point, they could not have searched the phone if he had declined to unlock it.
Counsel, let me add an additional fact, and just I'm kind of curious as to, I want to throw a little bit of a hypothetical. Same factual situation that we have here. Pops positive, called in by the agents, asked for counsel, then there's a request to consent to search the phone. But the agents happen to know from either confidential informants or whatever that the accused frequently texted information about drugs. So exact same circumstance, but the agents actually suspected that there really would be some good information on that iPhone. Does that change our analysis as to whether should be suppressed, whether or not this was interrogation, whether or not this was reinitiation?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that it actually changes the result in the factual scenario that you just gave us, because again, any type of testimonial aspect of entering his code into the phone merely would have established ownership. And the government already knew that this phone belonged to Apelli. So again, I think this is where the foregone conclusion doctrine comes into play, because the government already knows that. And so then again, it doesn't matter that they suspected that they might have found incriminating evidence on the phone. Because there's not a link, and they're not using the fact that the appellees owned his phone to further their search. It's not informing their search based on this knowledge that they learned. So if we're saying that the knowledge that they learned when he entered his passcode was simply that he owned the phone, that's not really going to change the way they conduct the search. It's not going to change what they're looking for, because they already knew it.
So the thought process would be, to the extent that it's incriminating because he's admitting that this is my phone and I have access to it, the agents would have been able to connect the dots anyway, so no harm, no foul?
Essentially, yes, Your Honor. They're not really gaining anything substantial from that knowledge that the phone belongs to him, that they learned by him entering his passcode.
So it sounds like you're now saying that it doesn't really matter whether or not the agents believed that the evidence that they were being granted access to was in fact going to be incriminating.
Right, I would agree with that. I think it would be a different factual scenario if somehow he was, by acknowledging ownership, he was acknowledging that the phone was used to commit a crime, but not necessarily that it might contain incriminating evidence. But again, it's going to be highly fact-dependent, Your Honor.
Right, so the issue is not whether the underlying phone will contain evidence of a crime and that the agents believed it did or didn't at the time, because, you know, you've done enough of these cases. It seems like every case, if there's a phone, there's some evidence that the government finds very useful in the prosecution. So to suggest that the OSI agents, you know, had no idea whether there would be incriminating information on the phone is not really realistic. But you're saying that that's not the issue. It's whether or not the question request for whether, I guess in this case, whether or not the then defendant accused could unlock his phone, since they didn't ask for the code, they just asked him to unlock it. There was nothing inherently problematic with that, because he was not giving them any information they didn't already know. This was not the situation where they picked up a phone at a crime scene and they didn't know whose it was, and so they started asking people, you know, could you unlock this phone, and then waited until someone said sure, and they unlocked it. Aha, now we've established ownership, something the government didn't know. Is that?
Yes, I think that's exactly the distinction, Your Honor. And in this case, any type of admission that he owned the phone was not adding to the government's knowledge in this case. And if we look at the Fisher and the Doe and the Hubble line of cases, that's really what the Supreme Court has been concerned with. Now, I do want to move on and talk briefly about MRE 304 and 305, because even if there was an Edwards violation in this case, the contents of the phone do not need to be excluded. Now, the Supreme Court has said that the fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine does not apply to mere Miranda violations. And if we look at our sister service court, the Navy Marine Corps Court of Criminal Appeals and Mazza, they talk about how what's good for Miranda is essentially good for Edwards too, because Edwards is a second layer prophylactic rule. And so again, it makes sense that normally if we're talking about a Fifth Amendment context, or a Miranda or Edwards violation, fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine does not apply. Now, in Emory 305, it appears that the president has given, has made a more stringent rule where potentially the fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine does apply to Edwards violations. But I think in this case that we have to look at Emory 304, because Emory 305 tells us to do so. And Emory 304b2 makes clear that there is an exception to the fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine if the evidence was not obtained by use of the accused's statement. And the government contends in this case that whatever testimonial aspect there may have been in the accused's act of unlocking his phone, that testimonial aspect was not used to retrieve the other evidence that was eventually found on the phone. In other words, the fact that Apelli may have owned the phone or he may have known the passcode, OSI didn't make use of that particular knowledge or that particular information to conduct its search. It only used Apelli's physical act of unlocking the phone to then be able to conduct its search. And so if we are looking at MRE 305 and 304, it is clear that suppression certainly is not required in this case, even if there was an Edwards violation. And the military judge did not even discuss this particular possibility. She just seemed to assume that if there was a Fifth Amendment violation, then it would be the case that the evidence would be suppressed. And that was an erroneous application of the law, and in doing so, she abused her discretion. And if there are no further questions, may I briefly conclude?
Very well.
Thank you. The military judge erred in suppressing Apelli's act of unlocking his cell phone and the contents of the cell phone pursuant to the Fifth Amendment. We respectfully ask this court to vacate the military judge's ruling and return this case to trial. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chief Judge Drew, members of the court, and may it please the court. It's good to be here in the great state of Texas, and I understand, Chief Judge Drew, your alma mater. I am Major John Legg, and I, along with Colonel Jeff Palomino, represent the appellee, Senior Airman Chad Blantley. When law enforcement asked, "Do you want a lawyer?" Senior Airman Blantley said unequivocally, "Yes." The military judge's ruling that evidence obtained from law enforcement's reinitiation of questioning should be affirmed for at least two reasons. First, law enforcement directing Senior Airman Blantley to enter his password twice to unlock and decrypt his phone and then disable security settings requested a testimonial act. Second, directing Senior Airman Blantney to enter his numeric password was testimonial because the information stored on his iPhone was not a foregone conclusion already known to the government. So moving to my first point, that there are two reasons, why law enforcement directing Senior Airman Blantney to enter his password twice to unlock and disable security settings was testimonial.
And counsel, before you get to those, you said directing him to unlock it. Is that just your characterization, or was there a finding of fact regarding either the voluntariness or lack of voluntariness in the accused choice to unlock his phone?
Well, if you look at the record, Judge Brown, I think it's on page 3 of the judge's ruling, the OSI agent, after he's requested a lawyer, says, "Do you have a lock on your phone? Yes, let me grab that. If you won't mind, A, just unlocking it and just turning it off, the lock or whatever for me." And then the accused has to ask how to do that, and then the agent directs him how to do that.
So you're not arguing, let me just back up, it's the findings of fact. This is Article 62, so we don't have the ability, the authority to find facts in this case. Did the did the judge make a specific finding of fact as to the unlocking of the phone that it was or was not voluntary? Because just in my reading of the ruling, it appeared to only deal with the initial consent.
Judge Brown, I think you're correct. I don't think that there's a specific finding on that. And I think one of the reasons is because the government's argument at trial has changed a little bit from an appeal. So the judge wasn't necessarily given the opportunity to respond to whether that was an issue. But I think your characterization is correct. So I'm saying directing, I think when an OSI agent in a custodial interrogation says, hey, can you unlock your phone? That's direction. We can call it a request. We can call it a question. But
in either case, it does not impact your analysis for our purposes.
Not in my opinion, Your Honor.
So I'm sorry. Follow up on Senior Judge Brown's question. So is it your position that, in reality, your client was not free to refuse to unlock the phone? That he was pretty much felt that he was at that point was directed to, and that while the words seemed to indicate he had an option. And in his mind, you know, the agent's asking you to do something, it's just the functional equivalent of directing him.
Chief Judge Drew, I think that that's an interesting question, and I think as a matter of law under Edwards, because Airman Blantney expressed his desire to deal only through counsel, the prophylactic rule, there's a bright line there, and if it's the functional equivalent under the Rhode Island v. Ennis test of questioning, as this court in Bondo said, it was not a routine incident of the custody, then that is involuntary. And we have to presume that it's involuntary. So to the extent that the judge did not make an explicit finding otherwise and the government did not contest that at trial, I think that you have to take the light and, the evidence in the light most favorable to Airman Blantney because he prevailed below.
Counsel, I think you're probably going to answer this, but just since you raised the distinction between what's questioning, interrogation, and what are routine matters in this context, after invocation and after request for consent, my question would be, when consent has been given to search a phone, why isn't it or is it a routine matter simply to ask that person to grant access to that phone, whether it's by unlocking it or providing a passcode? In this case, unlocking it. Why isn't that a routine matter?
Well, the only reason to ask for the passcode is to further the investigation. And that, this court said in Bondo, was not a routine incident of a custodial interrogation. So I think it's interesting, my colleague's argument, and I don't want to mischaracterize it, I'm sure this court won't let me do that, but it seems to me that the argument of the government is almost that as long as the government doesn't have any probable cause, they're just kind of on a fishing expedition, it's almost no harm, no foul. So if they don't suspect you of child pornography, they can ask you about child pornography. I know that that's a little bit farther along than what we are here, but that's kind of the analysis. And the reason why I think that's problematic is because Edwards gives us a prophylactic bright line rule, which is, I want a lawyer. Yes, I do. Questioning must cease if it's essentially to further the investigation. And the only reason to ask for a password would be to further the investigation. As the court said, everybody's excited about these smartphones because they can find just about anything on there. So that's the only reason. And honestly, you know, there really is no reason OSI would be asking for a password unless they're trying to find evidence of a criminal act.
Well, counsel, how is that any different than OSI asking if you'll consent to the search of his phone? Sounds like it's the same thing. I mean, obviously, they wouldn't ask him to consent to the search of his phone if they weren't looking to find evidence of a crime.
Well, I cannot argue under Frazier that consent is out of bounds. But I think that is a very specific and clear rule that's easy to apply. You can ask for consent. But then when you start getting into asking to produce a password, that's where it gets fuzzy. And I think that's where it gets to my two reasons why this is a testimonial act.
Just one more question before you
absolutely,
get
Judge.
There. So back to routine matters. There are things that can be asked for that are the case law says is okay. For example, fingerprints or handwriting exemplars, which may in turn turn out to be incriminating.
Sure.
But those are found to be okay because effectively they're not testimonial.
Right. Physical acts, standing in a lineup.
Give us reasons why this was testimonial. I think if I understand your argument that's coming. Is that right?
Yep. I think that there's two reasons. Number one is because it had him produce the contents of his mind to do it. So it wasn't put your thumbprint on the phone. It was enter something that is unique to you that only you know. So that's the first reason, and the military judge explicitly relies on that rationale, that it was testimonial because it required him to divulge the contents of his mind. And the second reason that's clear from the cases, but is not quite as clear from the record, perhaps because of the procedural posture of how this was argued below by the government, but basically when he put in his password that first and second time using an iPhone 6, which is clear from the record, he was essentially decrypting data. Decryption is where data, at first, information is unintelligible, and then by entering a key that only you know, it's a process that translates that data into something that's readable. And that is what happened in an iPhone 6 when Airman Blantney typed in his password twice at the direction of OSI, because we know from the record that he typed it in to unlock it, and that decrypts it so it's visible, and then he disabled that decryption, because the default is encrypted, at the request of OSI. So he had to produce the contents that only of his mind that only he knew just to enter the code, but also, and so that has, in and of itself, characteristics that are testimonial, such as implying that he's the owner of the phone, that he has excluded access, that he's responsible for what's on the phone.
All right, counsel, so let's go. In this case, there was a request to consent to search of his phone generally.
Right.
Right. Is it your position that that was an appropriate question and that does not run afoul of Bondo or Edwards or any of the other cases?
I wish I could argue that it's inappropriate, Judge, but I don't think I can. I think that under Frazier and Bondo, a request to consent is permissible, and I don't think I can argue otherwise, but...
Right, well, and so this is going to then drive to my question, which is if that is appropriate, if you can ask that question after they've invoked counsel.
Sure.
An individual granting consent to search something, doesn't that implicitly state that the individual has ownership, control, dominion of that item? And that seems to be what you're concerned about, is this following question is, hey, he's saying he has access to it. He says he has the ability to unlock it. But once he's consented to searching it, he's already said, yeah, you can search my iPhone. I own it, I control it. I mean, so I'm trying to figure out how you can concede the first question, but that it becomes problematic to ask the follow-up question of, hey, you said we could search it. Are you willing to assist us in facilitating that search by providing us the key or the code so that we can search the phone as you had consented?
Judge Brown, I think if we don't draw the line where Frazier has drawn it, which is you can ask for consent, but as in Bondo, you can't ask questions to further the investigation, then the courts are going to get into inherently complicated and potentially tortured analysis of the kind that my colleague is essentially saying, which seems to me that the less the government knows, the better for that purpose. And so I think that the court has to draw the line at consent, and they can search. And under some scenarios, that may mean that nothing else is required. Not all phones are locked. Not all phones are smartphones. A consent to search frequently doesn't require additional information. But when you said information to facilitate the search, I think that that's where it becomes problematic. Because essentially you're requiring the accused in a criminal investigation again, we're assuming this is part of the routine incident, which I think this court has already decided that it's not.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about where you're suggesting we draw that line,
sure.
Which is you can generally ask for consent, but it's a bridge too far to then follow it up with requests to facilitate the consent that was just given. And let's take it out of the realm of iPhone and smartphones and everything else. All right. So we've got do you consent to search of your vehicle? Yes, I do. Secondary question, maybe 5 minutes later, yes. Would you like to unlock? Are you willing to unlock the vehicle?
Would you
argue that would be a problematic question in light of the position that you're arguing right now?
I think the distinction is, and I think that I will say no, but
really?
Let me give you the reason. And granted, Judge, I didn't come in here expecting to talk about car keys, but I think the difference is when we're talking about a memorized password, it's information that's in the mind of the accused that only he knows. So if we're talking about keys, we're closer to the key to the safe analogy that the Supreme Court has talked about. But if we're talking about the combination, of course, that changes, and that's a distinction that's recognized in the case law. And so I think that your question is kind of asking, are keys as to memorized combinations? And I would say no, that they are not.
But wouldn't you agree that even with a physical key, that if I'm asking either can you provide the key or whatever, you are using your brain. You're going, this is where I keep my key. And if you've got a physical key, it may be, hey, my key is over here. Whereas in this case, if the answer is, key's right up here. Let me unlock it for you.
Judge, I see what you're arguing, but I think the distinction is the key to the safe versus the combination. And I think that that's the only principal distinction that we can make. So, of course, the military judge said that all of these additional questions were out of bounds in her ruling. You know, what color is your phone? That sort of thing. I think that the Supreme Court, when it talks about keys being different than combinations, that is a line that they have drawn that we can apply. And so we're talking about producing the contents of your mind, a passcode that only you know, and by doing that, by entering it, you are decrypting otherwise unreadable information.
In this case, though, was he requested or required to produce the contents of his mind? Did the agents ask him for his passcode, or did they ask him without telling them necessarily what his passcode was? He could turn his back if he wanted to unlock the phone, which sounds an awful lot like unlocking a door, as opposed to some, you know, there are digital locks on doors these days.
Sure.
You know, where they either asked him for the code to his door or directed him to input the code to his door. Here, that seems like they're just asking him to unlock it. Right?
Chief Judge Drew, I think that that's a distinction that the Supreme Court has not accepted. For example, in the Doe 2 case, the court said a communication essentially need not be verbal to be testimonial. And at page 210, note 9, they note agreement on this point with Judge Stevens' dissent. The focus is not on whether the communication is spoken, but whether it involves by word or deed an expression of the contents of the accused mind. In contrast, mere physical acts that do not express the contents of their mind are not testimonial, such as wearing a particular shirt, blood samples, providing a handwriting exemplar, that sort of thing.
Now, the case that you cited about the communication need not be verbal, is that a case involving a consent? Because the question we have here is not one in which you have probable cause search warrant, and then now we need the appellee to facilitate the ability of the agents to execute that warrant by inputting a code, unlocking a door, whatever the case may be. Here, he's already consented. And in essence, aren't they just simply trying to facilitate his will, that is, his desire to provide the access, the contents of his phone to the agents? I mean, he had the complete option when they asked him if he'd consent to say no. Yet he said yes. So aren't they merely carrying out his desires, if you will, his directions, by having him unlock the phone so they can do what he has already consented for them to do, which is have access to that phone?
No, Judge, I don't think that they are. And I think that this court has already said in Bondo that a request for a passport is not a routine incident of a custodial interrogation. So I think that that line has already been drawn, and to draw it otherwise would be inconsistent. Of course, Bondo's an unpublished decision, but I would presume that this court would generally, unless there's good reason not to, to follow its precedent.
So counsel, on the facts of this case, once they got consent to search the phone, let's say they went to the phone, they tried to access it, found it to be locked. Essentially, that's the end of the story with the phone. Is that your, isn't that where we end up? Because you're saying that they really can't go back to the individual and ask them to open the phone at that point, or ask them anything, they may help open the phone. Is that right?
Not necessarily, Judge Harding. Not all phones are going to be locked.
Well, I'm saying this one, if it was, you sure. Get to a phone and it is locked, and you need some kind of code to get into it. And they've got consent to search that phone, but essentially they're stuck at that point. Is that right?
Judge Harding, if they don't have the means to get in and they're required to ask questions that are forbidden by Edwards, yep, to get into the phone, then that is the end of the matter.
So that's the unless, of course, rule. They have some way to, you know, virtually break down the door, so to speak. But you mentioned Edwards, and I would just ask, do you think that was the concern in Edwards that they had? The reason they made the Edwards rule was envision a circumstance where after consent's given that Edwards would be invoked to prevent access to the phone for which consent was given?
Well, I think the purpose of Edwards, Judge Harding, is to give a bright line prophylactic rule so that once an accused has expressed his desire to deal with the authorities only through counsel, as Airman Blantney did, that questioning must cease and law enforcement continues further questioning at their peril. And so I think that that's the purpose of Edwards, to vindicate our constitutional right to counsel. And I think that there are good reasons for that rule, and it should be applied in this instance. However, I do want to proceed to the foregone conclusion doctrine that was discussed by my colleague from the government. And I would argue that directing Airman Blantney to enter his numeric passcode was also testimonial because the information stored on his iPhone was not a foregone conclusion already known to the government. Now, this is a alternative and independent reason. In other words, the foregone conclusion doctrine essentially acts as a exception to the act of production doctrine. And although it was not, the act of production doctrine was mentioned in an email by the senior trial counsel below, but foregone conclusion was not. So essentially, I would argue, consistent with the 11th Circuit's decision, that under the facts of this case, investigators were not able to establish the foregone conclusion doctrine. The Fifth Amendment protects testimonial acts of production that are explicitly or implicitly communicative and not foregone conclusions.
Counsel, do we have any evidence that OSI could not have independently unlocked this phone? I mean, the Apple case that most people are familiar with, which the FBI, after the Apple company refused to unlock the phone in that case, they found some unnamed consultant who unlocked the phone for them. Do we have any evidence that OSI couldn't have done exactly the same thing? And does that matter, that OSI didn't need him to unlock the phone, that this was just this made it easier, but nevertheless, through their, you know, spooky techniques, they could have unlocked the phone on their own? Is that fact that we don't have here before us, would that be significant in any way?
Chief Judge Drew, if there was evidence that the government could show the existence of files on the phone through its spooky techniques, to coin a phrase, then that may change the analysis, because that might get us closer to whether there was a foregone conclusion. But of course, the government here did not present any evidence to that effect. And so I'd hesitate to speculate how far the government's spooky techniques could get us. But I think that could be relevant in a future case, potentially. However, when the government demands the surrender of records from a suspect, the suspect's resulting act of production is testimonial if it entails implicit statements of fact from the Doe 2 case. The facts need not be direct evidence of guilt, but can be information that forms a, quote, link in the chain of evidence needed to prosecute from the Hoffman case. For example, by producing documents in compliance with the subpoena, the witness would admit that the papers existed, were in his possession or control, and were authentic. As the Supreme Court said in Hubbell, production is always testimonial where the government does not know the existence and location of the evidence, or where production would implicitly authenticate the evidence. Where the act of production implies testimonial facts, the government may only compel a suspect to surrender records if those acts are a foregone conclusion already known to the government.
Is that what we have here, though? Again, those cases deal on compulsion. Is that what we have? We have the, and this is not a case in which there was a compelled disclosure that you would have in a search warrant. We have a consent, freely, voluntarily given. I believe those were the findings of the trial judge. So we have consent, and all the agents are trying to do is follow what the your client has already agreed to, consent to search of his phone. Presumably, they meant consent to search the contents as opposed to examining the physical outside and, you know, look and see if there's any dust. I mean, we assume that what he consented to, what he knowingly consented to, was the contents, the digital files on his phone. Would you agree that that's in fact what he was consenting to?
No, Your Honor. In this case, consent to search is not the same thing as waiving the right to counsel, where the police have to ask more questions that are forbidden by Edwards in order to facilitate the consent. So I think that that's the distinction here, because we have to presume that those are compelled under Edwards if they were not routine incidents of the custodial relationship. So I'm simply not going to concede that consent is the same thing as the police asking more questions such as what's your passcode. I'm simply not going to do that. Well, and the judge found otherwise.
Yeah, and that's certainly consistent with your position, but and it is an interesting matter of law that after someone has clearly and unequivocally invoked their right to counsel and expressed to the investigators their desire to communicate through counsel only, that nevertheless, you can still ask them to consent to search of all kinds of things. And in this case, that would include his phone, his vehicle, and his residence. And that the law as it currently exists says, oh, that's no problem. That's not an interrogation. You don't need to talk to your counsel about that. No problem. I mean, that is an interesting, you know, legal matter that seems to be well settled, that this court doesn't seem to be in a position to be able to alter. But having said that, courts have said, and courts way above us, that you can nevertheless ask for consent, which they did. He gave consent, voluntary. The question before us is, having given that consent, can they then ask him to say, all right, you've consented, could you please unlock this? And I'm personally having a hard time trying to distinguish between that scenario, our scenario, and the same thing. I mean, he consented to the search of his vehicle. Are you saying that if his vehicle was digitally locked, that they would have been unable to ask him to unlock his vehicle through maybe an app that he has, which many cars now have apps? Would they likewise been unable to ask him if he had a digital cipher lock on the door to his residence, ask him to unlock that door so they can do what he consented to? Is it your position that both of those two scenarios would likewise be impermissible, despite the fact that he consented, because he had invoked counsel?
If the question that they are asking essentially is asking for a testimonial act, producing something from his mind, as what occurred here, then I would say yes. And I think that distinction is made clear in the cases. Is it a it is certainly a evolving area of the law, which is why we only have two circuit courts that have of appeal that have published decisions implicating this. So, and of course, as this court knows, the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces argued a case implicating this very scenario this week. Judge Drew, this is a conundrum, but I think what the court has to do is to apply the Edwards rule in concert with, you know, whether this was a testimonial act. And if you look at the 11th Circuit,
wouldn't it be a proper distinction to draw a line between when the government asks a suspect, someone they're interrogating, who is invoked counsel, when the government asks that person, what is the combination to your phone, your safe, your car, your house? Tell us that information. Versus, would you please unlock your phone, your car, your house? And does it matter whether that process of unlocking means reaching into your pocket, pulling out a physical key, inserting it into a lock and turning it, or reaching into your pocket, pulling out your smartphone and typing some numbers into that, or on the keypad of the vehicle or the door? Isn't that maybe a distinction we could draw between you tell me what the secret password is versus you don't have to tell us that, just please unlock the door by whatever means you need to do that?
Judge Drew, I disagree with that, because I think that essentially gets rid of the physical acts versus what I explained earlier. Again, a communication need not be verbal to be testimonial. The line is whether you are producing information from the contents of your mind. And I think that's different than putting your thumbprint on a phone. That's different than providing a blood sample or standing in a lineup. Those are physical acts. But where you're conveying that information that has communicative aspects, that's testimonial.
But doesn't that really come down to the example we talked about with your colleague? And that is where ownership is in question. We don't know whose iPhone this is, and the mere asking for the unlock the phone is in fact communicating, I have, if not dominion, I certainly have knowledge about this phone that the government didn't have. Versus we've already established it's your phone. You've already consented. Please unlock this for us. I mean, aren't those distinctions where the mere act of unlocking does in fact have testimonial value and communicate something, that is my phone, which is not a question in this in our case.
Chief Judge Drew, I see that I'm out of time. May I answer your question briefly?
Please
conclude. Chief Judge Drew, I think that the distinction is essentially the reasonable particularity portion of the foregone conclusion test. So I would argue that you have to show more. It's more than just the question of ownership. It's that the government has some additional knowledge. And in all of these cases where the courts have said that it was okay to compel the information, the government had fairly particularized knowledge of what they were looking for. Whereas here, everyone concedes that they had no probable cause. They had no idea what they were looking for. They merely hoped to find something incriminating. For the reasons stated, we respectfully request that you affirm.
Thank you. Counsel.
Your Honors, I just want to make about three points in response to appellee's counsel's arguments. The first has to deal with Edwards and what questions are appropriate or allowable after someone has invoked the right to counsel, especially when that person has also voluntarily consented to a search. And for example, if we look at Neely, which is one of the cases from this court that was cited in our brief, an accused invoked his right to counsel, but then consented to a search and was asked to identify which of the three lockers in the room belonged to him. And this court in Neely found that that was not a question that was prohibited. In fact, it was allowed. And they said that there could be a different result in a case involving the accused's identification of property that might have been connected to the crime. But in this particular case, that was not what the reality was. And the identification that the particular locker belonged to him could have been found out through other means. And I think that's very similar to what we have in this case. Because again, the questions, if they were questions, or the act that was eventually the result of the OSI agent asking, would you mind unlocking the phone, all that really told the agents it indicated that there was a possession of the phone by the accused. And so, again, it's the same thing. They already knew that information, and it wasn't adding to the sum total of what they knew. And I think also if you look at one of the circuit cases that we cited, United States v. Henley, that case made clear that it's okay in asking for consent to search to ask these follow-up questions to make sure, or to rather to set the parameters of the search and make sure that the police officers are searching the right container, the right piece of evidence, the right phone. The court called that good police practice, and that's what we're talking about in this case. All these follow-up questions that facilitated the OSI agents completing the consent to search form, they were simply incident to the original request for search, and they weren't really telling the OSI agents anything that they couldn't have easily found out otherwise, or that they didn't already know.
Counsel, the appellee cites to an unpublished decision of this court, Bondo. My question to you is, do you believe the rationale of Bondo is contrary to your position here?
No, because I think Bondo is distinguishable in several ways. Number one, Bondo was a search authorization case, and in a search authorization where the accused in that case was not even told via the search authorization, you have to give up the passcode to your phone. And this court left open the possibility that a search authorization could compel an accused to produce his phone. So, I mean, automatically there we're different. Also, in Bondo, the accused did speak out loud his password. And I think that gets to what Chief Judge Drew was talking about in some of his questions to appellee's counsel. Is there a difference between speaking the password out loud and simply entering it? And certainly there could be. I think the government would probably advance arguments that speaking your password out loud is not necessarily prohibited by Edwards and the Fifth Amendment. But again, that's different from the scenario we have here. But if we look at the cases, the Supreme Court cases where there's concern with speaking your password out loud, it talks about the language used is disclosing the contents of the mind. And here there was no disclosure of the contents of appellee's mind at all. That his password was kept to himself. The OSI agents never learned what his password was. The only thing that was possibly actually communicated by entering the passcode was that appellee owned the phone. And again, the agents knew that from the fact that he left the phone outside the room. He had it on his person when he came in. And furthermore, it was established by the acknowledgement or the consent that was given to search the phone. Again, that act of consenting also tends to show dominion and control and ownership. And this court, our superior court, the circuit courts have all said that consent, giving consent such as that after Edwards, after an invocation of the right to counsel, does not violate Edwards.
Now, that Bondo course was the Bondo case, excuse me, was an unpublished opinion of a different panel of this court. As such, we certainly can choose to either follow it or not, depending on whether or not we find Bondo persuasive. You want to take a shot as to why this court should not find Bondo to be persuasive?
Yes, Your Honor. And Chief Judge Drew, I see my time is up. May I answer the question?
Please.
So I do believe that this court should depart from Bondo. I don't think that the panel that considered the Bondo decision really looked into all the aspects of what is actually being communicated by an accused when he gives his password, and also did not consider whether or not whatever was communicated by the accused, by either entering his password or saying that password, whether or not the agents actually made use of the testimonial aspects of that admission in searching the phone and eventually finding evidence. And I think that gets back into my discussion of MRE 305 and 304. And so even if there was some testimonial component in Bondo to speaking the password out loud, I don't think that the agents made use of it in such a way that would require suppression. And so I would ask the court to take that into consideration in deciding this case and future cases as well that may deal with this issue.
Counsel, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And counsel, thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. And we'd like to especially thank the University of Houston Law Center for hosting the court today. The court will render a decision in due course. The court is closed.
All rise.